Okay, if you need a single image to kind of understand the state of the world in mid-October 2025, picture this massive, like, split screen, dynamically changing. On one side, you've got maybe the highest level of diplomatic success you could imagine, real history being made in the Middle East.
All right.
And then on the other side, just relentless gridlock, shutting down vital services right here at home.
It really is an extraordinary study in simultaneous global pressures. You see these huge breakthroughs, you know, forged under just immense pressure.
Yeah.
And then set against these domestic challenges that seem, well, entirely resistant to any policy solution. Doesn't matter how much political will seems to be applied.
Exactly. And, you know, we've poured through a pretty significant stack of sources this week. Reports covering, I mean, everything from the final really harrowing moments of a hostage crisis to the economic pain that tariffs are causing, like in your morning cup of coffee. Our mission isn't just to, you know, list the facts. It's to connect them for you.
Yeah.
To show how these things that seem separate, global pressures, domestic pressures, are actually, well, intertwined and driving the news cycle right now.
We're looking for the why behind those headlines. So let's start where the emotional stakes are probably the highest. That geopolitical earthquake that has really redefined the region this month.
The overwhelming human focus, the sheer gravity of this whole geopolitical shift, it has to be the return of the final living Israeli hostages after, what was it, 737 brutal days?
737 days.
Yeah.
Israel was finally preparing to receive them. They believe it's 20 people remaining alive.
Wow.
And the emotional weight of this moment, I mean, it's almost impossible to overstate. Mm-hmm. When you read the accounts from families like Moshe Levy's family,
yeah.
They're waiting for his brother-in-law, Omri Marin.
Right.
The reality of that separation just hits so hard. Omri has two young daughters, and the sources, they really highlight these painful details.
They do. The four-year-old, Ronnie, she remembers him. But Alma, the two-year-old, she was just 6 months old when he was taken. She literally knows her father only from a poster. Levy talked about the family's anxiety. You know, they worry Alma won't recognize the person who comes back. Only the strong, healthy man in the picture she sees every day.
And that anxiety is, well, it's earned, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really underscores the high price of this whole deal.
Mm.
Because this return, it represents the first phase of a massive ceasefire agreement. It's a tremendous political and human trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
The release of those 20 living Israeli hostages is being exchanged for the release of hundreds, possibly even nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees.
And what's fascinating here is the sheer diplomatic force that was needed. I mean, the sources make it crystal clear this historic agreement was brokered by President Trump.
Right.
He's actually traveling to the region for the signing in Egypt, and he's scheduled to address the Israeli parliament, too. This whole effort is being framed as the successful execution of this 20-point plan aimed at securing a lasting peace.
And you immediately see the political spin starting, right? Israel's ambassador to America was quick to call the deal a victory,
yeah.
Emphasizing that the nation is simply being whole again. But is it really a victory when the cost is potentially releasing up to 2,000 people, many held for terrorism-related offenses? Isn't that framing sort of masking a deeply painful compromise for the government?
It's absolutely a painful compromise, no question. But the... You know, the sheer relief of those reunions stands in such brutal contrast to the scale of devastation that still remains. There's new drone video coming out of Gaza City.
Oh, yeah.
And it just reveals catastrophic destruction after 2 years of war.
The reports convey such profound loss and ongoing suffering. You hear about displaced Palestinians battling for humanitarian aid, like literally fighting for every scrap. Mm. There's one man recounting how his brother died just trying to secure a single bag of flour.
Yeah.
The civilian suffering is... It's immediate and just overwhelming.
The story of Amal Abu Rabir is truly devastating. Her husband was killed in an Israeli strike. When she finally went back home to her neighborhood,
yeah.
She found everything gone.
Yeah.
Just gone. She was desperately searching, hoping maybe to find some of her husband's clothing or even just a picture, you know, something to hold on to.
Of course.
And astoundingly, the only thing she found intact amidst all the rubble was one colorful notebook belonging to her children. Just the small, vibrant reminder of the life that was just flattened.
And that immediately shifts the focus, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To the critical need for survival, for reconstruction.
Yeah.
This ceasefire has to be a viable lifeline.
Absolutely.
We noted that the UN finally managed to bring cooking gas supplies into Gaza. It's the first time since March. That's huge.
It is.
And the World Food Program, the WFP, they say they're ready, but the aid flow needs to surge. massively.
Yeah, the UN says they need 600 trucks daily to really ease the suffering. But they've only recently managed to hit, what, 170?
170. That gap is just massive.
Huge.
It is. And the situation, it's been confirmed as dire. The WFP has confirmed actual famine conditions in parts of Gaza City, where 400,000 people are basically cut off from the rest of the strip.
Mm-hmm.
The, I guess, good news, if you can call it that, is that the WFP has food stockpiled for the next 3 months.
Okay.
That logistical pipeline is ready to surge assistance, you know, the moment security and access really permit it.
Okay, so let's pull the lens back now and look at the domestic scene, specifically that severe political gridlock. Because while the U.S. was brokering world peace abroad.
Yeah, the contrast.
Right. Back home, the federal government shutdown hit day 11, and there's really no end in sight.
What's kind of remarkable here is how often these high-stakes foreign policy successes happen against a backdrop of, well, fundamental domestic failure.
True.
And the consequences of this gridlock are just cascading. The Smithsonian Museums, the National Zoo, they ran out of funds. Closed.
Mm-hmm.
And chillingly, over 4,000 federal workers were sent actual termination notices.
Termination notices. And the sticking points in Congress are, well, they seem to be fundamental political disagreements. The sources indicate Democrats are pushing really hard for health care subsidies and also reversing recent Medicaid cuts.
Right.
For our listener, can you just briefly frame what those cuts mean? Why are they the hill Democrats seem willing to die on here?
Sure. So Medicaid, it's the core safety net program for low-income Americans, right? And the proposed cuts, they basically affect state funding and eligibility requirements, meaning they could reduce coverage for millions of people.
Okay.
And similarly, that push for healthcare subsidies, that's about lowering costs for people buying insurance on the marketplace exchanges. So for Democrats, blocking these measures, or rather allowing these cuts to go through, is seen as jeopardizing fundamental access to healthcare.
Right.
Which makes it pretty much impossible for them to pass a budget that includes them.
Now, the administration did prioritize one thing, though, military pay. The Pentagon apparently found $8 billion of unused research funds from the previous year, specifically to make sure service members got paid on time. Is that evidence of smart crisis management? Or does relying on pulling funds from research suggest something deeper, like a structural failure in budgeting that sacrifices long-term readiness for short-term fixes?
I'd argue it's mostly the latter. Look, it's a necessary stopgap, right? You have to prevent a morale and readiness crisis among active duty personnel.
Here.
But diverting $8 billion from R&D, that means delaying innovation, future preparedness, essentially a very large IOU against the Department of Defense's future capabilities, and purely because the legislative branch can't agree on basic spending levels.
Speaking of things people can't agree on, let's transition to another pressure point, one hitting people's wallets every single day. The surging cost of coffee.
Oh.
And this isn't really a climate story anymore, is it? This seems to be purely a trade policy story now.
That's exactly right. We hear from Gregory Zotis. He's the founder of Gregory's Coffee. He notes that consumers are already being, quote, more choosy about where they spend that, you know, $4 to $7 on a beverage.
Yeah, I bet.
So the consumer's cautious already, but the real cost shock is coming from above, from policy.
And the sources point to the clear culprit being tariffs. Specifically for coffee.
Absolutely. So while the company, Gregory's, successfully managed to move production of like ancillary supplies, paper goods, things like that domestically to dodge certain tariffs.
Smart.
Yeah, but the actual coffee beans.
Yeah.
You're getting hammered. Brazil, which provides the majority of their sourcing,
right,
now faces a staggering 50% tariff.
50%? Wow. Why is that specific number so high? I mean, what's the policy rationale for such a punitive tax on something everyone drinks?
Well, this is a classic example of protectionist policy leveraging. These really high tariffs are intended either to force trade negotiation concessions from a specific partner, in this case, Brazil, or maybe to incentivize domestic sourcing of certain goods. But here's the thing. Since coffee is a tropical commodity, there is no viable domestic alternative.
Right. Can't grow it here at scale.
Exactly. So the tariff simply becomes a pure cost burden. It fuels inflation directly to the consumer price. There's nowhere else for it to go.
Which means the price paid at the store for just a pound of coffee has already jumped by more than $2.50 compared to last year.
Yeah.
It makes menu price hikes, as Gregory's owner admitted, pretty much inevitable. So these tariffs are translating global trade policy directly into friction for like our most cherished daily rituals.
Okay, so if the last segment highlighted kind of man-made friction points, this next one reminds us that nature provides its own relentless pressure. Mid-October brought this powerful bicoastal weather threat hitting the U.S. simultaneously.
Yeah, we saw two massive systems at play. On the East Coast, you had this powerful coastal storm, what we often call a nor'easter, just sort of meandering off Delaware and New Jersey.
Right. Those can be nasty.
Oh, yeah. These systems are known for sustained high winds, extreme flooding. It prompted New Jersey to declare a state of emergency. We're talking 50 to 60 mile per hour winds, potentially up to 8 inches of rain in places.
And significant coastal flooding and erosion expected, yeah, affecting tens of millions of people.
And then completely conversely, the Southwest was getting just overwhelmed by heavy rain. Arizona saw water rescues.
Mm-hmm.
And Colorado actually issued a disaster declaration because of flash flooding and rock slides, particularly in the Southwest region. How does this kind of volatility immediately impact the listener's life beyond just, you know, travel delays?
Well, volatility translates directly into cost. Increased frequency and severity of these events, they immediately strain municipal infrastructure, you know, roads, drainage, utilities,
right,
which eventually means higher local taxes down the line.
Mm.
But more immediately, the insurance industry reacts pretty quickly. They raise premiums, coverage for things like flood or coastal erosion becomes harder and, frankly, more expensive to secure.
Mm.
So the cost of adapting to this volatility, it's almost like an invisible tax on everyone.
And we see that impact clearly in agriculture, too, right? If we connect this to the broader picture of climate impact, the Canadian apple harvest offers a pretty painful case study, okay, especially for growers in Quebec.
Yeah, they faced immense challenges this year. After a really mild winter, the 2024 season was defined by, and this is a quote, a crazy drought all summer long.
Crazy drought.
This resulted in, well, fewer numbers, fewer apples and smaller apples across the board. And the sources confirm that those relying on older methods, maybe without extensive irrigation systems, they suffered the most catastrophic losses.
That puts just tremendous pressure on the agricultural industry then to invest heavily in new, you know, climate resilient infrastructure.
Precisely. It's really no longer optional, is it? It's becoming an existential question of investing in modern irrigation systems just to survive a growing season in many places.
But let's end this segment with a genuine source of hope, a massive milestone in public health. Especially fitting since it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Yes, this is truly excellent news and really a testament to decades of research and awareness campaigns.
Mm.
Over the last 40 years, breast cancer mortality has actually been reduced by over 40%.
40%? That's incredible.
It really is. And this success has driven policy shifts, including adjusting the official screening recommendations to start earlier now at age 40.
Okay. However, the data also reveals these, well, stubborn disparities that we really have to acknowledge.
It does. And it's critical we talk about this. While overall survival is definitely up, Black women, when you match them stage for stage with white women,
yeah,
they are still 40% more likely to die of breast cancer. That racial disparity remains a critical, frankly, unsolved challenge. It really highlights the ongoing need for equitable access, not just to screening, but to follow-up care as well.
Absolutely crucial. And looking ahead to the cutting edge of prevention, I know a huge amount of hope is being generated by cancer vaccines.
Yes. The concept of utilizing the body's own immune system to fight cancer and specifically focusing on preventing recurrence after initial treatment is showing immense promise.
Right. Cancer vaccines, including those that use the mRNA platforms that, you know, listeners became familiar with during the pandemic.
Sure.
They're showing, quote, incredible results in clinical trials, offering real hope. Not just for treatment, but potentially for long-term prevention down the road. Hashtag tag outro.
So what does this October 2025 snapshot ultimately tell you? I mean, it tells us the world is defined by this really strange, contradictory tension. We've witnessed these high-speed diplomatic achievements, yeah, literally saving lives in the Middle East,
yeah,
which sources describe as relying on decisive personal pressure right from the very top. Real intervention.
And yet simultaneously, we see these grinding, ongoing fights against seemingly simpler problems, right? Domestic gridlock, the relentless force of nature, these economic pressures like those staggering tariffs, all of which just seem to resist rapid, elegant solutions. The pace of change, the pace of adaptation, it's just deeply uneven across different areas. It really makes you look at those levers of power, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If tariffs are now fueling economic distress across basic goods like coffee, this global, unavoidable consumer pressure point, what kind of decisive lever, maybe one not mentioned in these reports, might actually be required to ease that specific global economic burden?
That's a great question.
We saw personal diplomacy apparently solve the hostage crisis. What kind of political or, I don't know, regulatory pressure might finally resolve that domestic healthcare subsidy deadlock that has literally shut down our own government?
That really is the core tension, isn't it? The world seems to respond to two very different kinds of pressure.
Yeah.
That high stakes personal intervention on one hand, and then the grinding structural necessity on the other. That's definitely something worth mulling over as you watch the news unfold next week.